Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, the CEO of Wisdom Labs and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs' Meghna Majumdar talks with Tara Nicole Nelson. Tara Nicole Nelson is on a mission to help 100 million people live lives of freedom, growth, and joy. She is the founder and CEO of Soul Tour, a personal growth and spiritual community producing programs like the School of Upliftment for Business. Tara is the author of the book, The Transformational Consumer. She led marketing at MyFitnessPal from 45 million to 100 million customers and through the company's acquisition by Under Armour. And now, Tara Nicole Nelson, interviewed by Meghna Majumdar.
Tara, welcome to Wise at Work. I'm so excited to have you here with us.
I am thrilled to be here.
So last year, you came out with a book called The Transformational Consumer. And having read it, it was one of those books where every page I just kept yelling out, yes, yes, this is the way I wish all marketers, all people who are trying to sell things actually spoke to consumers. And so I think a lot of us know what the term consumer means, but it's not usually attached to the word transformational. So can you tell us more about what you mean by putting those two words together?
Yeah. It's funny because when people come into my work at this stage in my career, they often see things that are not necessarily marketing related. And in many of those things, one of my sort of core messages is that you, human, are not actually a consumer. You are a creator. And that means you're not a consumer and not a reactor and not all of these other things. But the truth is that we do engage in a marketplace. We humans in 2018 do engage in a marketplace, some of us avidly, some of us more avidly than others. And I believe and now have the data to back this longtime belief of mine, which is that there is a massive and growing group of humans who see all of their life, every activity in which they engage, including marketplace behavior, as an opportunity to change their lives for the better, for the healthier, for the wealthier, for the wiser. This group of people are the group of people that I call the transformational consumer. They tend to be early adopters of things because they're always sort of out trying to mold and level up their own behavior, mold and level up their own citizenship in this world, level up the world around them. They're very open and willing to experiment with new products and new things. So they tend to be early adopters. They also tend to be highly influential on the buying behavior of the people around them, because the people around their personal brands, if you'll allow me that silly device of applying brands to people, they tend to be known in their circles as people who are always knowledgeable about what works to make change. So I joke, if you've been both vegan and paleo, you are very likely a transformational consumer. So the people around them tend to know that, and they often tend to seek out from them, you know, guidance on what to use, what to buy, what brand, what blog, what to read, etc., to make whatever the changes that they want to make in their lives. It's a very natural thing for people to see how that is applied to, like, health and fitness endeavors. But I also think that, like, in your specific subject matter of how are we and who are we in the context of our work, it's actually not that hard to apply the transformational consumer construct or the overarching framework of someone who is always on the lookout for how they can be better, do better, feel better in every area of their life.
I think why I loved the book and that way of thinking was finally recognizing myself. Yes. And not seeing that it's weird.
Yes.
That there are actually lots of people out there who do want a different kind of life than what they've known.
I've been working in this valley for many years now and had developed this sort of thesis and hypothesis in my work as a marketer at a bunch of different companies over the years. But this book gave me the excuse to go out and actually get data to back it up. And so we did a study of about 2,000 U.S. only, so just to be clear, consumers. And over 50% of them answered in a way that we define them as a transformational consumer. So that basically looks like at least 3 times a week, they're going to a brand, a content, or a product in an effort to make their lives healthier, wealthier, or wiser, or to achieve some sort of health, wealth, wise goal. It's resonant because it's real. And it's not a West Coast thing. It's not just a young person thing. We saw it across age classes. We saw it across demographics. In fact, I'm really, really not a fan of demographics. I think it's one thing to start with a thesis about a demographic you want to serve and create something that really beautifully serves them. That's cool. But my strong belief is that people's aspirations are a better lens through which to serve them with products and content than their demographics. So you cannot see me, podcast listeners, but I am a 42-year-old Black woman who lives in Oakland and is an entrepreneur and is a transformational consumer. And I cycle a whole bunch and I yoga a whole bunch and I work out a whole bunch and I grow a bunch of my own food and I write a lot. I believe that a business is better off trying to serve me through the lens of all of those things that I try to do and the reasons that I try to do them than they are through the lens of me being a 42-year-old Black woman who lives in Oakland. So it is not only resonant, which I hear a lot. People read the book because they're ostensibly trying to market or create something that serves this group of people, but they very often self-identify as that in this group themselves.
Yeah, and I think that is a great segue into many of these transformational humans, these people who want to be healthier, wealthier, and wiser, are also managers and employees.
Yes.
And, you know, there are always these, do this to get more productivity, do this to help people manage stress. I guess, given your experience, given your survey research, what do leaders need to do to keep these transformational workers engaged and being able to bring their best?
I believe that an increasing number, if 50% of the American consumer set are transformational consumers, it is likely that at least that many people in a given workplace are also transformational consumers. Depending on what the subject matter of your company is and what your product is, maybe way more, right? Like my last in-house larger company role was for the world's largest health and fitness app. I would honestly be hard-pressed to find someone in that company who wasn't a transformational consumer. People specifically want to work on that stuff because they believe it serves someone like them, or they believe that they are, you know, called or led or driven to help other people. So assume that there are a lot of transformational consumers in your employee base. Also, take a look at the employee engagement statistics. Early in the book, I talk about one of the big questions that this book poses a bunch of answers to is the question of the customer disengagement dilemma, which is that every brand you know is creating more and more and more and more and more content, and people are engaging with it less and less. All right, this is a conundrum, guys, right? So a lot of the book is about how to get people to care about what it is that you create, and in other words, how to create things that people care about.
Yeah.
Right? The employee engagement statistics are no exception. In fact, they're kind of worse than the customer engagement statistics. I read a Gartner report that said something like 70% of employees in this country range on this spectrum of disengagement from like a little kind of meh and bored to like toxically hateful about coming to work every day and about the work that they have to do when they get there and about the employer for whom they're doing it. So everything about the framework of the transformational consumer, all of the things about how to rethink what you offer in terms of how do you reframe your product as essentially a transformation, a lever, a removal of frictions, an increase of ease in a transformational journey that your customer already wants to make, you really can and should be applying that exact same framework and that exact same reframe and thinking to your company and the experience of working in it. Transformational consumers will seek for every single area of their lives to move them on this like progress path toward healthier, toward wealthier, toward wiser. That is equally true with their employment experiences as with everything else. And they're always on that mission. They're always vetting that. There's no, you have a good company culture document and you're done, right? It's like on an ongoing basis, they'll always be doing that. And we also just know, like, they tend to be very entrepreneurial. There are people to whom, you know, the sort of new era of contract work and consulting work and gig work will really appeal for a lot of reasons. That said, I've found that these people love a mission. They love a mission. They have a finely tuned BS detector. But if they believe that, like, the leadership of the company is deeply, deeply committed to a mission to help the world become better, and what that looks different for different people, or to help customers, like a deep customer centricity in a company, they love that. So I would say things like, know what your mission is. Mm-hmm. Know what it is that you're asking people to do over and over and over again to create the after picture of the world that your vision should sketch out. And then make sure every single person in your company actually knows what their particular everyday work is doing to help drive that bigger sort of mission engine.
I want to jump in and just say it's not just about curating the right words to talk about a mission. It is really that felt sense,
yes,
of, you know, when you're in it with brothers and sisters in arms,
yes,
and you know when you're just being taken advantage of,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
the man.
Yeah. And then there's a thing, this is going to seem weird, but the older I get, the more okay I am with being a little weird.
Uh-huh.
We'll talk a little bit about more of the work that I do now. And in studying the way that people experience matters of soul and spirit, I came across this term that I got like a little micro obsessed with. And the term is collective effervescence. Collective effervescence. So collective effervescence is that like energy that is greater than the sum of the individual people in the room that comes up when you're like all meditating and everybody kind of just drops down that like one notch and you're like, whoa, what just happened? Or all in yoga, or all in spin class, moving your bodies in the same way, or all at Burning Man, or all in church, or all at whatever.
Or all in brainstorming session.
In, right? Exactly that. So it is that exact same thing when you are in, no matter how much people love to be consultants and gigs and out on their own and doing stuff, and these people are prone to like that, there is that sort of energetic rush of working on building something big that you know matters, that you know changes people's lives. They like that.
Yeah,
we all like that.
And I know you quote this person a lot, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, mm-hmm, and she has this beautiful poem where she talks about how we were made for these times.
Yes.
And
I love this quote.
And yeah, we were made for these times.
Yes.
And this idea of collective effervescence is made for these times.
Yes. So this quote comes from a piece called The Letter to a Young Activist. And it's funny because if you read this letter, it feels like somebody wrote it last week. And it was written, I think, 20 years ago. But the idea is that so many people who see themselves as transformational are sensitive to the plight of the world, right? And it is tempting sometimes to grow weary and watch the news and grow faint. And this letter is an encouragement that we were actually built specifically for times like these to put our souls fully on deck through whatever it is that we do so that others can catch light from that.
Yeah. Soul on deck shines like gold in dark times.
I love it.
So
that's marching orders right
there.
Yeah.
So you recently went on a soul tour.
Yes.
Across the United States. And I'd love to learn more about that. How did that come about?
Yeah.
What were you trying to do on this soul tour?
Yeah. So the original soul tour came about when a company, Lightspeed Venture, a venture capital fund, approached me. They said something like, you know, they'd heard about my Black Church Lady of Silicon Valley reputation. And they also know that I know a lot about content and a lot about how to reach and engage hundreds of millions of people. So they wondered if I would consider starting some sort of spiritual app And I sat down with them and talked, and they had a particular idea that did the specifics of it didn't really work for me. But what we decided to do was I essentially affiliated with them for 6 months as an entrepreneur in residence. And I took that time to explore what I might like to do in this space, and more specifically, what customers actually want and need in this space. And so, you know, in the transformational consumer, I talk a lot about having to rethink your customer in terms of understanding every stage of the journey of transformation that they're trying to make that might include your product or your content along the way. And I used to run a customer research firm. So I chose to take a piece of that 6 months and do this deep dive customer research project. And I called it my soul tour. So I went to a bunch of cities around the country. I talked to people about what soul is, what soulful life looks like to them, what spirit means to them, what do they do to care for their souls. I went to a bunch of churches and Zen centers and temples and meditation classes and retreats and individual spiritual gurus, you know, pay $100 and come watch me talk for a couple hours. I went to all of those sorts of things and sort of started to build an understanding of really what soul and spirit look like in this time, which is very different than it looked like a generation ago.
So can you share some of the high-level stuff? What does soul look like in America today?
It's better than you think. It's better than you think. I thought I would go out and find a bunch of really hurting and upset people. And there are those, many of them. People are struggling with digital a lot. If there was one thing that I heard almost everywhere I went, it's something like, X tech company is ruining my life. There were basically three names that came up over and over and over and over again. It's ruining my life. I actually was talking with this journalist at CNN. We're going to go out into Central Park and do some soul tour questions for just some random people. And I mentioned to her, you know, people say on soul tour, X is ruining their life. And she said, oh, wait, can you help me? That's her personal problem, is that this particular social media platform she feels like is ruining her life. So that's an overwhelming thing. People are struggling with digital. They are struggling with social media. On the other hand, we have all grown this new body part appendage, right, called the mobile phone. And while it is very true, and I saw it very strikingly, that our country in particular is getting way less religious, people are spending a lot less of their time on traditional religious practices, they are getting what I would say is more spiritual. What people define and include in their spiritual practices is so personal, and it's way beyond church on Sunday or anything on a specific day of the week. It's watching TED Talks. It's specifically watching Brené Brown's TED Talks. She is like spiritual guru for the generation, you know what I'm saying? But it's also watching Jada Pinkett Smith talk about parenting. And the people who I see having come off soul tour as the spiritual leaders of this generation are often not people who are proposing to be spiritual leaders at all. Some of them are celebrities just being really transparent about their own journeys. Others of them are like subject matter experts like Brené. But people are able to get to that content, even though they're having to do it on a bunch of different platforms in a really haphazard way. And sometimes it's just because someone posted it on Facebook or whatever, that it comes to them. They may not be like regimented or systematic in it, but they see all of this kind of content consumption as part of their spiritual practice. They also see, you know, things that they do to take care of their physical body often as part of their spiritual practice. So spin class comes up, yoga comes up a lot. Many people talk about meditation as part of their spiritual practice, but I also, one of my big findings on Soul Tour, and you may have heard me talk about it in other places, is that people experience meditation anxiety a lot, which I'm like, guys, we're doing it wrong. Like, you don't have to do it a perfect way. So I have programs in which I teach meditation, and I almost never call it meditation specifically because I saw so much triggering come up around meditation as a thing that people feel like is hard or has to be done a very specific way or that they're doing it wrong. But they want to do it. They want that stillness. So that's cool.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from this is people are drawn to other people being vulnerable. And yes. So they are able to be vulnerable. And allowing room for that. I think there was a time when there was just no room for vulnerability. And now it seems like that's the only way we're going to get through.
It's the only way. And I think for this generation, by which I mean this generation of spiritual practitioners, which is not just, you know, very young people, but specifically in some of the data, it's like in the 50-ish and below range. I think that the time has passed in which these people are willing to accept spiritual leadership that just tells them what to do. I think people are much more interested in models of spiritual well-being. And that is not to say models of perfection or models of polish. Mm-hmm. It's like models of what real messy life really looks like and how you handle it for better or for worse, and then how you reflect on that and contemplate it and connect the dots. That's the jam. That's what people are interested in, because that's personal connection. The only way humans really ever deeply connect with each other is through sharing personal experience and through listening, yeah. Right? So that's what I think the next era of well-being looks like.
And I know there's a lot of talk about AI and machine learning and blockchain and the rise of the machines, this whole tech economy. And my personal take is there's probably a lot more opportunity out there. It's just that there's a real PR problem because they haven't really talked about what happens to humans and what is the place of humans in this more technologically advanced future. So how do you talk to these doomsayers and pessimists? Yeah. You know, when people were talking to you about, you know, tech is making me crazy, what were some of the conversations you got into there?
Over a number of these conversations, I ended up coming up with a really succinct talking point, which is that technology is a brilliant servant and a terrible master. It just is. And humanity has always had things like that. Actually, every technology, including like
sticks,
basic knives. Tools, technologies from hundreds of years ago, these things were true for them too. And so when it comes to like people's management of their relationship with, you know, social media and like personal technologies like phones and stuff, that tends to create a helpful like aha space for people to be like, right. A lot of my work in general is in giving people permission to be contrarian, to do things a way other than they're seeing other people do them. Because many other people actually are out there already doing them the conscious way. They're just not posting about it on Facebook. They tend to be less noisy or less public. I think the same thing about these other things. Like, I actually have some interest in blockchain technology. But I think what happens is with all of these technologies really early, the people who are creating them are not necessarily marketers and aren't necessarily operating on any sort of objective around getting other people to understand like the uses of them. If you Google like blockchain 101, you get a bunch of slide decks with a bunch of diagrams on them. And a friend of mine and I, a friend who's an economist who literally teaches like economics 101 at UC Berkeley, and we have these conversations about this stuff. And she's like, you know, the thing with these currencies is like humans have exchanged value forever. And there have only been centralized regulators of that exchange for actually a really short period in human history. So what blockchain technology and some of these other currencies enable us to do is to kind of go back to how things were in terms of person-to-person exchanges of value without a centralized regulating body. So I'm a fan of like breaking things down to their most essential and getting to the essence of the question of them. And then from there, understanding how we might use these things as our servants and not masters. One thing that comes up for me, and I have a lot of conversations in my household about AI, is AI brings up a consciousness question that it's time for us to like dive into deeply as a species. Like, what is human? What is consciousness? I think those questions are fascinating, and I don't think we're really having them except as prodded by the AI debate.
Most recently, I went on a binge of Altered Carbon on Netflix. And I'm always struck by how dystopic any future with AI seems. And I'm transformational to the core.
Yes.
I really believe in humanity and human spirituality and a way to be in relationship with our technologies.
Yes.
And so I think there just aren't positive stories around
AI. There aren't as many.
And I think that keeps people from really exploring what it could be. I remember when I was 7 or 8, I used to imagine I could have a phone in my pocket. This was just me imagining it.
Who knew?
You know, this is late 80s. And all of a sudden, I'm living in that reality now, and it's way more mundane than I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know people who have a phone in their pocket and experience life really wonderfully as a result of it. I sometimes think, I'm a big one to go on these, little rampages of, appreciation about the world. And so sometimes I'm like, look at the things I can do from the airport. I was actually a lawyer forever ago. Right. And there was a time when 4:00 p.m. would come and a bunch of guys would come into the office with bikes, with big pouches, bike messengers waiting for our documents that had to be filed at court that day. We don't have to do all of that anymore. The things that we are able to do as marketers, as entrepreneurs, as employees.
As humans,
because of these basic technologies. I'm not even talking blockchain or, anything fancy. You know, to revel in and appreciate that kind of takes some of the dystopic off of it.
I'd like to switch a little bit. And one of the things you mentioned was managing our relationship to technology consciously. And I'm thinking this is probably part of your secret sauce to your productivity. You're one of the most productive and prolific people I know. And so what can you share about how to manage stress while being engaged in so many different ways on so many different projects?
Mm-hmm. So I have been that person that read all the things about stress management, tried all the things. I definitely have a deep meditation practice. It's core to who I am as a human. I also have a deep free writing practice. And I don't just do morning pages, which is a practice many people know. I do pages to process my world. So at any moment of the day that I need to process something where I start to feel stressed or anxious about something, I'm very, very likely to write freely about it. Not for output or to share with anyone, just as a form of processing. I do spend a fair amount of time getting out in front of the rest of the world. So I get up very early so I can have those contemplative moments. And I feel sort of bulletproof spiritually to the world when I'm done with that. So I don't let technology be the first thing that enters my awareness. Also, I just simply do not do things that are chronically stressful. I will stop doing them. I will quit the job. I will turn the client away. I will get out of the relationship. I really, over time, have come to trust my inner guidance system. And I've realized that I am of best service to this world when I feel great. And so that inner guidance system of chronic constriction stress, it's telling us something. So I have learned to listen before it gets bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is so huge.
Yeah.
And I have had my on-again, off-again relationship with morning pages from Julia Cameron's work. And I often look at them as the MOURNING pages.
Yes.
And so I love what you're saying about the writing. And I know that you do writing challenges. So do you mind talking about why that kickstarts flow and takes on resistance? What is it about the writing and that
it's
approach?
The way we do it. So I do run these 30-day writing challenges for conscious leaders and conscious creators. And literally it's just the challenge is to write something every day for 30 days. In the morning I send a pretty detailed, pretty substantive writing prompt, which some people choose to use. Others just free write. And then I send a nudge at night. And it changes people's lives just as a thing. And it's free. And now we've got 7,700 total people ish that have been enrolled in it in the last year. It's the way we do the writing. Just writing every day doesn't do that. Writing every day, knowing that it's not for output, no one's ever supposed to see it. It is a time in which you turn off your inner editor and critic and just brain dump poor emotions, words, your grocery list, a song lyric you heard, whatever, it's meant to be bad and sentence fragments and misspelled and bullets. I have a strong belief that we have this inner reservoir and pipeline of inspiration that is flowing to us and through us all the time. And turning editing on, inner critic on, thinking about how other people will receive what we're creating, that all closes up the pipeline, right? So all we're doing in the daily writing practice is just opening the pipeline of inspiration that already exists. And people struggle with it for a day or two or three sometimes. And by about 5 or 6, 7, they start having these downloads. You know, on day 1 or 2 or 3, they may not write too many words, but they'll get some level of relief because it just creates a little head space and heart space when you can have that place to pour your feelings unfettered. By day 5, 6, 7, people are like, I've never written more than 100 words in my life. I just wrote 5,000 words. They can't turn it off. And I don't let them. Yeah. Sometimes they ask, should I stop? And I'm like, don't stop. If you have to go to work to keep your job, stop. Otherwise, do not stop. Yeah.
Going back to that letter to a young activist, she talks about we are ships for these times. And what you're talking about, I imagine, is a ship frozen in ice, and by allowing the writing without the judgment, without bringing attention to it, you melt the ice.
Melt the ice.
So the ship can move.
I love it.
And once the ship starts moving, you can steer it.
Oh, you're all good.
Yeah.
And in fact, you can become kind of unstoppable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tara, thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
Has been such a, for me, inspiring conversation. And I hope it helps people really kind of think about their relationship to technology, their relationship to being healthier, wealthier, and wiser. And we will definitely be sharing with them how they can get in touch with you as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Meghna.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world. And as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.